You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 327, Morrissey, is it time to give up on Stephen? FIFA 2018, how football simulation games are becoming more popular than the real thing, and Hamilton the Musical, the UK launch has been delayed. Is London ready for this very American musical? I didn't think David Diddy Hamilton's life was that fascinating at Born to the Musical. Anyway, it's all coming up after Stevie Nicks with Tom Petty and Stop Dragging the Heart Around.
Stevie Nicks with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers from 1981. Wonderful single from that era. Stop Dragging My Heart Around. Understandably, the reports of the death this week of Tom Petty were overshadowed by the terrible news from Las Vegas. But it reminded me, you know, his career really took off first in the UK in 1978. When the Heartbreakers, they toured as support, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers toured as support to Nils Lofgren over here, and their first album and single were hits in the UK before anywhere else. So we've always warmed, I think, to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
He's sort of one of ours, really.
Exactly, yeah, adopted son. Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 327. I'm Terence Stackham, and live from the Hollywood of the south coast of England is Juliet Harris.
Hello, yes, from Hastings, home of the stars, it's me. Hello, everyone.
Jules, we've encountered Morrissey before on this podcast. Indeed, 2 years ago, we reviewed his peculiar novel,
yes,
You and I.
Yes, that popped up on my Facebook memories the other day, and so I chose to comment on it by just saying, God, I hated this, which pretty much sums up where I am with the Morrissey novel.
List of the Lost, it was called. And I do, yeah, I agree with you. I seem to recall we were less than flattering about his debut.
Weirdly, and perhaps slightly unexpectedly, you had slightly more time for it than I did, given that I'm a huge Morrissey and Smiths fan, which I think we'll talk about. I thought it was utterly. I thought his autobiography was quite good, actually. So I was disappointed as well, because I thought the autobiography was better than I thought it would be, despite being incredibly embittered throughout. Whereas I thought the novel was just terrible, really.
Well, I think collectively it remains the biggest waste of a day of our entire lives. reading a book. I mean, I speak as someone who spent time in public sector management meetings, so I know about
days drifting by. That is quite a cutting verdict, isn't it?
Yes. Now, this week, Morrissey popped up on BBC Six Music with a live set as he promoted yet another new solo album and on yet another new label. And he started rambling on about the UKIP, United Kingdom Independence Party, leadership contest, and how his seemingly favoured candidate failed to win. The voting was rigged. The rigged voting, he said. And this made me wonder if Stephen Morrissey is the Boris Johnson of pop music, almost endlessly destined to blurt out appalling, dismal rhetoric, but to be equally constantly forgiven by a sheep-like fan base. And Jules, I wonder, can we still keep looking back 30 years and say, yes, but what about how soon is now and this charming man, as if everything can be forgiven by the past?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good point. I'm also enjoying Mozza as Bozza, by the way. I think that's excellent. It's tricky, isn't it? There are so many people who would otherwise be really sensible and right on and you know, enlightened, I think, in their thinking. And that was very much, if you liked the Smiths in the 80s, that was a sign that you were sensitive and enlightened, wasn't it? And that you were, you know, you used your brain and you had deep feeling for fellow man and all that sort of thing. I've listened to a number of podcasts, and The New Statesman have recently started one called The Back Half, which is sort of a reference to the fact that the back half of The New Statesman is arts and culture. And it's hosted by Tom Gatty and Kate Mossman. And I think it's quite good. I quite enjoy it. It's got a very bizarre Japanese prog metal band theme. But if you get past that, it's quite enjoyable. And they both went to see this gig, Morrissey performing at Six Music, where he made these comments. And it was quite... I was slightly surprised, given that they write for The New Statesman, which is a left-leaning political magazine. They mentioned the fact that he'd made these UKIP comments, and the room fell a bit flat in the room. The room went very quiet, that sort of thing. But they didn't make very much of it, and they sort of focused on the lyrics on his new album, some of which they said were quite good, and they were sort of reviewing the album. I suppose that was right, in the sense that they don't do a political New Statesman podcast; they're doing a cultural podcast. But it did set me off to thinking, like you say, the extent to which we are willing to otherwise sensible people are willing to close our eyes because it's Morrissey. And I have to say, there have been so many incidents involving Morrissey's politics. And of course, although I love the Smiths and I do quite like a lot of Morrissey's solo work, I guess maybe it's a generational thing, in the sense that slightly younger people that like the Smiths largely is a nostalgia act rather than a kind of an act that you were living through in real time. All I've ever known is Morrissey's dreadful politics, frankly. I can just about remember my friend's brother having The Enemy, which had the Finsbury Park debacle with Morrissey wrapped in the Union Jack and doing songs like, well, the problem with that was, of course, it's all very well wrapping yourselves in the Union flag, but if you're going to do songs like National Front Disco, then, you know, it's not exactly sort of helping, really. And, you know, we've known that Morrissey's had dodgy views for ages, but having said that, I do feel now that I've had enough of Morrissey, and I do feel that I can't keep turning a blind eye to, you know, his dreadful politics, his not so much dreadful politics, and I don't agree with them, but the fact that he is so it's so desperate headline grabbing, really. And it's so, and I particularly have a problem, the woman Amory Waters, that he sort of expressed some sympathy for, it would seem. And they really tried to play this down on the New Statesman podcast, and they were really like, kind of, oh, it was meant to be a joke. And they again, and this isn't to criticise podcasts, I don't think it's great, but like you say, this willful turning of a blind eye, they took the approach, oh, no one really got it. No one knew who she was. And I was like, I do think this is slightly willful, sort of, oh, well, no one laughed because they didn't know who she was. It's like, no, maybe no one laughed because people did know who she was and did know that she had, is very anti-Islam, to the point where she's involved in setting up the British branch of Pegida, or however you want to pronounce it. So her views really are quite extreme. And you know, and I do find that a bit kind of, there is this sort of, oh, well, he can't really be that bad, can he? His Morrissey has always been controversial. So yeah, I do have a bit of a problem with the way in which he expresses himself. It's not so much the fact that he holds those views, it's the fact that he expresses it in such a headline grabbing oh look at me type way. Used to compare him to Boris Johnson, I find him more to be a Katie Hopkins type figure, I must admit, nowadays. And I just think, you know, fine, if you want to turn up in a wedding dress to the Tory conference, I mean, obviously Katie Hopkins, not Morrissey, that I would have been quite interested to see, but I just think, you know, I'm just fed up with the attention seeking. And also, we all know how this is going to end, because it ends the same way as a Morrissey always does, which is he'll cancel the tour a third of the way through because he's quote unquote ill. And then all of a sudden we'll find out that he's fallen out with his record label again. So, you know, I am weary of Morrissey's antics now, particularly when the stuff that he's producing, like that dreadful novel and like the solo albums, they're okay. The last one had some good tracks from it. Istanbul, I thought, was fantastic. And I thought, I've seen too many false dawns with Morrissey. Last time, I thought that album, I thought, oh, wow, this is going to be really great. And it was quite a good album. He's going to get his act together. This record deserves to be huge. And then before you know where you are, he's cancelled a tour and fallen out with his record label again. So I buy Morrissey's antics to be wearying, and particularly from a sort of a look at me, look at me, look at me type political sort of point that he's doing at the moment.
It's peculiar how some people find their entire careers ended by a terrible incident or remark. I was thinking of Michael Richards, who played Kramer in Seinfeld. He shouted some dreadful racist language.
Yes,
when
I remember that.
He was heckled at a live gig, and that was in 2006. And more or less, he's never worked again. Elvis Costello did something very similar in a hotel bar in Ohio in the late 70s. A lot of people won't have heard of this, which is, you know, it's this strange thing. If you Google it or Wikipedia or whatever, you'll find out what I'm talking about. And it's always skimmed over. And worse still, I think, Eric Clapton in 1976 on stage said, I'm appalling things. Again, Google will be your friend on this if you've never heard of it. Appalling things in a racial context. And he's continued, in fact, to wriggle about his views on immigration and what he would call racial issues in the 40 years since. But again, it's kind of glossed over, and we're supposed to salute Eric Clapton, the musician.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to come back on that point slightly, interestingly, And maybe this is Morrissey's fans growing up with him, I'm not sure. But so the National Front disco singing, Union Jack waving, Finsbury Park debacle, that was in the early 90s, wasn't it, 1990-91. Actually, to be fair, in the pages of the NME, which had far more influence then, I mean, we've talked about the sad demise of the NME previously, but that really did lead. There was more than one music paper then, obviously, but it really much did lead a lot of sentiment. And they, I think it was Stephen Wells and co, they really were not at all impressed by Morrissey and the Union Jack. And you know, it splashed all over their pages. And actually, I think it did affect Morrissey's career for a bit. I think then it did. People sort of were his kind of vegetarian style fan, you know, did go, what's that smell? I don't like it very much, and kind of walked away for a bit. And it is perhaps a sad indictment at the times that, you know, we work on this assumption that we're becoming more enlightened all the time. And I think that Brexit is going to test that to its very limits. But it is weird that now there is somewhat less of a scan of a sort of a storm, isn't there? Maybe this is the Twitter era. The Twitter era, people say about, you know, what people call Twitch fork mobs and how, you know, people blow up over things. But the disadvantage to that is that things move much quicker. So the outrage over his comments on Anne Marie Waters, although I did that much like my kind of reaction, I did note from Twitter that in amongst the anger and the kind of the outrage, there was a kind of a bit of an oh no, not again type feeling. But it blows over quicker. Whereas when you had the music press and things like that, things stayed around for at least a week because they were weekly, weren't they? And possibly even more so if they did a follow-up. So I find it quite interesting. Maybe it's because, I don't know if it's because Morrissey's fans are now 25 years older and getting to that middle point in your life where you do need nostalgia and to feel to be young again. I don't know, but I do find it quite interesting that in a time that was allegedly meant to be less enlightened, there was more of an outrage at Morris's comments than there is now, it feels like.
I think you make a key point there with the social media aspect, because perhaps the big difference is the eras in which they happened. No cell phones to capture those, the Eric Clapton, Elvis Costello, and
yeah,
indeed
absolutely.
The Morrissey 1990 incident, whereas Michael Richards and Morrissey 2017 were caught on tape, and that's probably the big difference. If, like me, you don't own a PlayStation or an Xbox, the monumental rise of video games may come as a surprise. We're looking at that next, after, from their album A Week Away, Spearmint.
This song's dedicated to some of the best bands in the country, some of the bands we never got to hear, bands that never got any records out, never got played on the radio, never got written about in the press. This song's dedicated to Open Up. This song's dedicated to Set Liquidator. This song's dedicated to Super Swords. This song's dedicated to Arga, Kix, Interrogate, Seize the Infidels, Chance, and Laverne and Shirley.
I sometimes feel I'm sweeping the nation, showing my invisible friends. This is where I used to live. Well, doesn't your bone ever land? The emasculation of a good friend is nothing I should be singing about. The tattoos all look gold and faded and stupid with a suit.
Turns to me and saying, Shirley, don't worry. As long as you stick to what you believe in, everything you want will come to you.
I
I'm very, very fond of this tune, I must admit. It always, and I love the fact that it shouts out forgotten bands at the beginning, some of whom Shirley, the singer, is actually in, including Laverne and Shirley. That was Spearmint and Sweeping the Nation. I'm very much looking forward to seeing them soon. I've got a, I've involved in organising a festival. I think regular listeners will know that I play in a band, and my bandmate Sarah and our friend Amelia are organising a one-day festival down at the Angling Club in Hastings called Indie Rock and All. And it's on Saturday 21st of October, and Spearmint headlining. We've got 10 bands and various DJs, including Emma Anderson from Lush, doing things during the day. You can buy tickets online. It includes a your ticket includes a buffet at one point, and there's also, if you're willing to pay an extra £5, there's a curry supper as well. So and it's to raise money for Grassroots, which is a suicide prevention charity. So it's Indie Rock and Ore, spelt O-R-E, because there is an area of Hastings called Rock and Ore down by the seafront. So it's a kind of a pun on that. And there's an event link on Facebook, and I might persuade Terence to tweet the link later on as well.
Absolutely. No, it sounds really good, and I didn't realize it was for such a good cause as well, but it sounds like a really a good day, good evening. So
I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And the Spearmint, one of the great unsung UK indie groups,
yes,
as well.
Yes, I really think so. Yeah, I agree.
About 2 years ago, I found myself in the hospitality area at Chelsea, as one does, and I was...
As you do, anyway.
I was helping myself to the generous buffet luncheon.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I was chatting to a fellow guest. It was the football commentator, Martin Tyler, and incidentally, one of the nicest blokes, fellows in broadcasting, Smashing Man. And to get to the point, during our chat, when I said, I think I said to him, oh, you know, you must have one of the most recognisable voices in sport. He told me that when he does get recognised by his voice around the world, it's almost never because of his work on Sky Sports, but it's due to him being the commentator for FIFA 18 and all its predecessors. To give the full description, a sports simulation video game. And it's played all around the world on desktop PCs, laptops, PlayStation, Xbox, Nintendo. And these FIFA computer games are updated each year, as probably many of you know. And as an example, to show about how impressive they are, FIFA 12 holds the record for the fastest selling sports game ever. It generated $186 million in its first week of release. Now, the reason I don't play these football simulation games is not because of my age or some sort of superiority kind of complex. It's quite the reverse. I know I've got a personality that can become addicted. Yeah. And I fear I'd be one of those people who stays up for 48 hours trying to get Chelsea to win the Champions League, you know, with a blanket around me. You know. So I avoid the temptation. But Jules, many analysts are seeing these video games as a positive, a way of bonding and cementing friendships.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really interesting, like you say, that these football games have taken on a kind of a relevance that seems to go beyond just them being a football game. I'd also expand this to other games. I think we've spoken previously on the podcast about the football manager simulation games, which in a way are even more, and I say this proudly as someone that plays them nerdy, than the FIFA games. Because the FIFA games, basically, you play, for people that aren't unfamiliar with them, they're basically a football simulator. So you play a football match. So it's a football game and you control all the players when you're playing the game. These football management things, there is less gameplay action because what you're doing is you're making decisions, managing a team, basically, so deciding who's going to play and who you sign and all that sort of thing. Because the idea of Football Manager, and I think it's the same with FIFA, is that if you are willing to put 48-hour shifts in or whatever, or you just keep playing it, you can go many, many years into the future. So, you know, I've played a game before that's lasted 15 seasons. So you can go really far. And the makers of Football Manager have managed to do a model, have modelled their future game. The latest edition, if you buy it, has three different scenarios depending on what happens with Brexit.
Oh, good Lord.
So it has a scenario about, and to what extent free movement of players is restricted. And actually, that's a very interesting consequence of Brexit that we'll need to see played out. So you could either have a scenario where there was freedom of movement was the same. There was a scenario where, you know, there was some visas involved, and there was a scenario where there wasn't any freedom of movement. And so in a way, and their take was basically, look, why is Brexit in such a mess politically? When we make a computer game and we've been able to model future scenarios, why isn't this happening? And so the FIFA game, interestingly, you have a situation, and it's like this now. It's always been like this with Football Manager. It says in this New Statesman piece, In this way, FIFA has changed the way we consume the full circles of football. FIFA aficionados will rate the transfers of unknown players based on FIFA ratings and a hyper player accordingly. Before Eden Hazard and Romelu Lukaku became household names, they were unknown 16-year-olds in FIFA with extremely good stats. Teenage boys who played the game closely may well have known about the future superstars before Antonio Conte or Jose Mourinho ever did. And I think that's really interesting. And I've known this from Football Manager before, and we used to have a bit of a kind of a laugh about this when it was when there was a version called Championship Manager years and years ago that me and my friends used to regularly play. There were certain players who you suddenly knew had really good stats, who used to tip each other off about who you should buy. The first versions had loads of bugs in it, which were, I think, semi-deliberately attached to loads of players. If you signed Yan Mulby, for example, it meant that none of your players ever got injured or something. It was full of really old kind of ticks like that. So I think it's quite interesting that FIFA, the game is based on data, obviously loads and loads of data, sort of Optima stats and things like that. And it's actually really interesting that from that point of view, it gives you perhaps more knowledge than people in the trade, really. And I think this talks about the other way in which it's important as well. And I think this sums up sort of where football's going and how it's harder for younger people now. It says here, in its essence, FIFA translates the culture of going to see your team play every weekend or going to the pub to watch the game with your mates for the teenage boy unable to afford a season ticket or too young to drink. Now, of course, in ye olden days, no offence, Terence, I suppose when you were sort of a young boy and then a teenage boy, you could afford to go to watch Chelsea play.
Oh, very much. You just rock up on the day and pay a few quid at the turnstile and walk in, yeah.
And I think that does actually sum up, it's quite sad in a way that you've got a generation of young people who would otherwise be participating fully in going to football matches. But because, as we seem to talk about every other week on here, because, you know, the money has become the driver to football to such an outrageous extent, it means it's impossible with them. It's impossible, right, to do so. And also, it's interesting that you know, it gives them more ownership in a way. And I suppose I was like this with football stickers. If you're a kind of a big sort of collector of things and a big collector of knowledge, I guess it does give you some sort of ownership of the game. This says here, 12-year-olds now know who every player in every major league is. And it's regardless of how skewed FIFA stats may be, we should know who's faster than whom and who's better at taking free kicks. So it's quite interesting. And also, of course, there's the cultural side of it is where you can play online. And this, yet again, is where the internet has completely changed things. You can play in tournaments with your friends over, and I'm going to embarrass myself by not knowing all the terminology, so I don't go there. But the different gaming platforms have kind of an online element now whereby you can sort of play with your mates, and you know, you wear those headset things and you can chat along and stuff like that. And that's quite nice in a way, that it is sort of creating a community, even if it is people sat in their bedrooms. It does make me feel a bit better about things if there's an online side that you can kind of all be together. So it's quite interesting how FIFA has become this kind of a microorganism. And to some extent, maybe that's because football itself, the real life football, has become so inaccessible.
I've noticed that not only fans are heavily wedded to football video games, when players are joking with each other when they're joking with each other on social media, it's often about their scores or successes playing these games. And in those features in football programs that you buy outside the ground for extortionate sums, they usually have a feature about getting to know, you mentioned Eden Hazard, for example, or whoever. And when they ask the player, what do you do to relax? The ones without children nearly always say, I play FIFA 18, yeah. Or similar games. And I've watched my nephew playing football video games, and they are, to the uninitiated, startlingly realistic.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And also, I totally agree with what you say, the young men and women I know that are interested in football and play video games in their teens and their 20s, they have an extraordinary knowledge of footballers all across the world that initially you would think, well, how do you know who's playing centre-back for Romania in this World Cup qualifier? And, of course, as you say, it's all because they know all these players through the buying and selling and playing against teams on FIFA 2017-18 or whatever.
Yeah.
The only thing I would say, maybe it's a little bit out of date or old-fashioned view, but I think these games are only a force for good if the lifestyle is balanced by some proper outdoors.
Otherwise,
we're all going to become welded onto our sofas and chairs, aren't we,
if we
go out at all. But I, as I say, as someone with something of an addictive personality, I certainly do. I'm not knocking it at all. I certainly would be the same. I'd be in my chair for long hours at a stretch playing these games, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
The stage musical Hamilton has been a huge success in America and should have been opening here in the UK in London in a few weeks, but it isn't. What's going wrong with Hamilton? That's next after Martin Stevenson and the Dainties.
So sorry about your friend, I heard he died the other day. Met a team of tall old men, came and carried him away. Over where we church had drowned, where cracks like together around to river up into a Lewis for the dead. Well, some good of me for calling in. One guy be pleased with me for mourning. I'm a hypocrite, a crocodile crying. And it feels so good. I take advantage.
so good.
I know I do say this quite often about my music choices on this podcast, but here's another artist who is scandalously underplayed and largely, I think, unknown, despite a magnificent body of work from over a span of, God, 35 years. From the same era and roster of artists as Prefab Sprout and the Kane Gang on Kitchenware Records, that was Martin Stevenson and the Dainties from their debut album in 1986, the album Boat to Bolivia, and that was the opening track, Crocodile Crier.
Lovely.
Now, Jules, in one sense, the musical Hamilton is guaranteed to be a success over here.
Mm.
11 Tony Awards, the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for Drama, and a Grammy last year for Best Musical Theatre Album, all from its run in New York, of course. It was always going to generate huge interest over here, and it's already sold out right into summer 2018. But the UK previews were due to start on 21st of November, and now we hear that the opening has been pushed back to the 6th of December, and this has caused problems. Actually, it's very similar to the Ryanair fiasco, because despite assurances, people who had tickets for the cancelled shows between 21st November, 6th December, are now finding they can't rebook into dates that suit them. And you know, I always wish every show opening, especially in the West End, nothing but great success. I know firsthand how much blood, toil, sweat, tears, and of course mainly money, goes into getting a production on the stage. But once a show starts creating problems and delays, it's all too often that more and more issues arise. And I wonder, how confident are we that the London Hamilton will be the success that it has been in New York, as in New York?
Yeah, and I'm not sure. I mean, I had to say, to some extent, Hamilton's kind of passed me by a little bit. And this, I think this is interesting and relevant, actually. So for listeners that don't know, Hamilton is a sung and rapped through musical about the life of American founding father Alexander Hamilton. It was inspired by a biography of him that came out in 2004 by Ron Chernow. It's got hip-hop and rhythm and blues and pop music, and it's got traditional style show tunes as well, and it's got colour, what they call colour-conscious casting of non-white actors as the founding fathers. It's kind of a musical for a woke generation, I suppose, should we say. And so it is very, very popular with a certain streak of sort of, and it has to be said, embarrassing, well, mostly embarrassingly white liberals, but not all. And everybody in my Twitter timeline that I saw trying to get tickets to Hamilton was exactly who I would expect them to be, and that they were people that were like me, basically, with middle-class white people. I'm not familiar with it. I go on and off musicals a bit. I like the classic musicals. I struggle a bit with modern kind of self-conscious show tunes. So it was announced that it was going to come over here to Britain, and there was an inordinate scrum for tickets, as you can imagine. And I don't know for sure, but I suspect that if they didn't exactly play into that, then the producers of Hamilton weren't exactly disappointed by that. But the danger, of course, is that if you are going to allow this fire to be stoked, that it is the hot ticket and it's zeitgeisty and it's now, if you then can't get people tickets or you have to cancel it, if the whole appeal of the show is that you have to be there to be seen, which I think it was to some extent, I have to be honest, and I haven't seen it, so I don't know how good it is. But I mean, everyone I know that likes it is really into it, so I'm not sure. But it does kind of strike me a bit that, you know, you're kind of asking for trouble. Shades of Theresa May here and the Conservative Party. You fail to manage expectations and allow people to run away with the ideas that it's going to be the best thing ever, and, you know, you have to be there and blah blah blah, then if you can't deliver on that, that's awfully more staining than if you say that you have amazing artistic content and then you don't, you're only average. Even though people feel let down by the fact that you know, something culturally is not as good as they thought it would be, I think that clings on and is less damaging. Because to some extent, if I've seen stuff that I thought artistically was going to be brilliant, it turns out to be all right, I am disappointed for a bit. But eventually I come round to thinking in my head, well, you know, art is art, isn't it? And people should, you know, God, not exactly God bless them for trying, but, you know, the idea that, you know, maybe there are bits about this I'm not getting, or maybe it's just a taste thing. Not everybody likes everything. Other people might think this is good. Whereas if you've so badly messed up trying to get the show on, people that are trying, that have bought tickets, paid money for tickets on previous dates, they've said, oh, we're going to do different dates now. Said, I've seen people angrily tweeting emails about this. Send us your top three preferred new dates, and then we'll get you into one of them. And then sending out emails saying, sorry, we couldn't get you into any of your new dates. And it's like, hang on, what? How can you, if people bought tickets previously, how can you not get them in to new dates? I don't understand. There must be a way. If you've got a certain amount of people that have bought tickets in the first place, surely if you sold them for the same number of dates, I don't see how you can't organize this, really. And like I say I think I would find that far more irking, and I would remember, or irksome, I would remember that far longer for trying to buy a ticket for something that I wanted to see and not even getting to see it and judge it because I got, you know, got moved on. I couldn't go, I got moved away from being able to watch it. That would stick with me far longer than seeing something and thinking maybe it wasn't quite worth all the hype. I don't have a great deal of faith. I think they've squandered an awful lot of goodwill, and it is sometimes a bit difficult to come back from that.
I think it's really interesting the point you make about expectation over actual experience. And I wonder how some people will feel, because I did some research and when I knew this was coming up this week, and I found that some secondary ticket sites, the parasites of the music and theatre world.
Yeah, parasites, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Are offering Hamilton tickets at £4,500 for one ticket, per ticket in December, £4,500. And I mean, I think these people selling theatre tickets at that much profit should be put in the stocks, frankly. But Hamilton can only be deemed a success, I suppose, at the moment when we measure it against some spectacular flops in London theatre in recent years. The Piccadilly Theatre seemed to have a curse for a while, the terrible Spice Girls musical. Do you remember? It was scripted by Jennifer Saunders.
Yes, that should have worked, and it didn't.
Collapsed there in 2012. Also, it was the venue for Cameron Mackintosh. Again, an unlikely name for a failure, but
his
Moby Dick, which it certainly didn't last as long as Captain Ahab's Search in the book.
Right.
Murderous Instincts lasted a week at the Savoy recently, and proving that one success, I'm fascinated by this musical, by the way, proving that one success doesn't always lead to another. Lionel Bart followed Oliver in the 60s with Twang, which was about Robin Hood. It was a disastrous musical, and it was extraordinary cast. It had Barbara Windsor and Ronnie Corbett. But the thing is, it was really strange. I don't know quite how this happened, because they were big names in the 1960s. Bernard Breslau was in it as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It played to empty houses at the Shaftesbury Theatre in 1966 and closed after 43 performances. But it's with sadness that the award for the biggest flop in recent London theatre history, Mike Read's Oscar, which closed after one night, the press night, at the Shaw Theatre in 2004. So measured against that, Hamilton's already a runaway success.
Well, quite, yes.
But there is that aspect, though, that we said, there's a sense of doom. Once a play or a musical or anything in the West End starts to go wrong, then quite often the little snowball becomes an avalanche. So we will keep an eye on Hamilton its run in London starting in December. Jules, we know that any venues that you're appearing at in the next week will report record takings.
Oh, well, that is, as ever, far too kind, I think. I will be, where will I be? I will be, this sort of coming week, I will be doing Indie Wonderland on Barricade Radio. That's from 8 until 10 p.m. So the venue will be your very own home that you can listen to me
ears,
in.
Yes.
You can do Indie, Alt Rock, or Miscellaneous Tunes and listen to me doing a bit of chat. So that's barricaderadio.com, Wednesday evening, 8 to 10 p.m. I've got a sort of busy October and November coming up. So basically, other than that, I'll be sort of sat inside a venue, trying to calm myself down in advance of that, really. By the way, if you do, speaking of radio and sort of listening to things, if you do enjoy the podcast, then please do feel free to go onto iTunes and give us a review as well.
That would be most welcome indeed. Thanks also to executive producer Rona. Don't forget,
as ever, yes.
Yeah, don't forget to check out her project for Grenfell Survivors at unbound.com. It's the book anthology 24 stories. And
to clarify that, then it's spelled 24 in numbers and stories is in IES, isn't it?
That's
so
right,
stories, yeah.
Exactly. And to play us out, Jules, a single that edged into the UK chart in 2012.
Yes, indeed. It felt, how can I put this, somewhat culturally and politically relevant this week when the slightly unfortunate Theresa May and her cough-tastic speech at the Conservative Party conference led me to think of this tune, which I very much enjoyed. I was working in a job for a few months where I was having to commute every day.
I thought you were going to say I was working as a waitress in a cocktail bar.
Yes, I did, and that did. That's why I got distracted, because that did twang in my mind. But so I went over to, I was going to Lewis and back every day, and I worked in an office where we had to have Radio 1 on all the time, and it certainly drove me up the wall. But one of the tunes that occasionally I used to hear things and I'd think, oh, that's quite good. And they used to play this Cough Cough by Everything a lot. And it's a bit of an earworm. And I then bought the album. I bought Everything's first album and really enjoyed it. So it was nice to kind of be reminded of them. And I think this is a fantastically inventive and interesting song anyway, I think. So why not play it this weekend? I saw them live a year or two ago supporting Foals at Wembley Arena, and they were excellent. So this, by Everything is Cough Cough.
Yeah, wait a second. Telling me that I want more. A not eureka moment hits you like a cop car. And you wake up just head and shoulders in a glass jar.
You have been listening to a DACA Media production.